The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 11th reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, Werner's school begins to deteriorate. Instructors are called up to serve in the war. Electric service is sporadic with surges and outages. Gasoline and live ammunition are no longer available. Cadets are informed of their father's deaths in the war. In March of 1942, Dr. Hauptmann told Werner that he was being transferred to Berlin. In St. Malo, French policemen question Madame Manek and Etienne about Marie-Laure's father and his letters and anything he may have left behind or brought with him. Etienne scolded Madame Manek about her activities in the resistance. Werner was told that because he is really 18 years old, which he is not, he will be sent to a special technology division of the Wehrmacht. Werner went to Berlin to see Friedrich. Because of his head injuries, Friedrich must be fed, drools, and cannot communicate. In June 1942, Madame Manek catches pneumonia and dies. August 1944. Marie-Laure hears someone enter the house on Rue Vaubarais. The intruder walks with a limp. She entered the armoire on the sixth floor and the secret passage to the garret. In the Hotel of Bees, Walter Baron died. Von Rumpel, the intruder, climbed to the sixth floor of number 4 Rue Vaubarais and found the model of St. Malo. Werner is trying to make a radio in the basement of Hotel Bees, but it does not work, as we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. He turns over the dented radio case, peers into it, wraps Volkheimer's fading light back to life. Settle the mind. Envision the distribution of circuit. He rechecks the fuses, valves, plug pins. He toggles the receiver send switch, blows dust off the meter selector, replaces the leads to the battery, tries the earphone again, and there it is, as if he is 8 years old again, crouched beside his sister on the floor of Children's House, static, rich and steady. In his memory, Jutta says his name, and on its tail comes a second, less expected image, twin ropes strung from the front of Herr Seidler's house, the great smooth crimson banner hanging from them, unsoiled, deeply red. Werner scans frequencies by feel. No squelch, no snap of Morse code, no voices. Static, 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 static. In his functioning ear, in the radio, in the air. Volkheimer's eyes stay on him. Dust floats through the feeble beam of the flashlight. 10,000 particles turning softly, twinkling. In the attic. The German shuts the wardrobe doors and hobbles away, and Marie-Laure stays on the bottom rung of the ladder for a count of 40, 60, 100. The heart scrambling to deliver oxygenated blood, the mind scrambling to unravel the situation. A sentence Etienne once read aloud returns, "Even the heart, which in higher animals, when agitated, pulses with increased energy, in the snail, under similar excitement, throbs with a slower motion." Slow the heart. Flex your feet. Make no sound. She presses her ear to the false panel on the back of the wardrobe. What does she hear? Moths gnawing away at her grandfather's ancient smocks? Nothing. Slowly, impossibly, Marie-Laure finds herself growing sleepy. She feels for the cans in her pockets. How to open one now without making a noise? Only thing to do is climb. 7 rungs up into the long triangular tunnel of the garret. The raw timbered ceiling rises on both sides toward the peak, just higher than the top of her head. Heat has lodged itself up here. No window, no exit. Nowhere else to run. No way out except the way she has come. Her outstretched fingers find an old shaving bowl, an umbrella stand, and a crate full of who knows what. The attic floorboards beneath her feet are as wide across as her hands. She knows from experience how much noise a person walking on them makes. Don't knock anything over. If the German opens the wardrobe again and yanks aside the hanging clothes and squeezes through the door and climbs up into the attic, what will she do? Knock him on the head with the umbrella stand? Jab him with the paring knife? Scream. Die. Papa. She crawls along the center beam, from which the narrow planks of flooring emanate, toward the stone bulk of the chimney at the far end. The center beam is thickest and will be quieter. She hopes she has not become disoriented. She hopes he is not behind her, leveling a pistol at her back. Bats cry almost inaudibly out the attic vent, and somewhere far away on a naval ship, perhaps, or way out past Parame, a heavy gun fires. Crack, pause, crack, pause. Then the long scream as the shell comes flying in, the thump as it explodes on an outer island. A ghastly, creeping terror rises from a place beyond thoughts. Some innermost trapdoor she must leap upon immediately and lean against with all her weight and padlock shut. She takes off the coat and spreads it across the floor. She dares not pull herself up for fear of the noise her knees will make on the boards. Time passes. Nothing from downstairs. Could he have gone so quickly? Of course he's not gone. She knows, after all, why he is here. To her left, several electrical cords wind along the floor. Just ahead is Etienne's box of old records, his wind-up Victrola, his old recording machine, the lever he uses to hoist the aerial alongside the chimney. She hugs her knees to her chest and tries to breathe through her skin. Soundlessly, like a snail, she has the two cans, the brick, the knife. 7. August 1942. Prisoners. A dangerously underweight corporal in threadbare fatigues comes for Werner on foot, long fingers, a thatch of thinning hair beneath his cap. One of his boots has lost its lace, and its tongue lolls cannibalistically. He says, "You're little." Werner, in his new field tunic and oversized helmet and regulation Gott mit uns Belt buckle, draws his shoulders back. The man squints at the huge school in the dawn, then bends and unzips Werner's duffel and rifles through the three carefully folded NPEA uniforms. He raises a pair of trousers against the light and seems disappointed that they are not remotely his size. After he closes the bag, he throws it over his shoulder. Whether to keep or merely carry it, Werner cannot guess. "I'm Newman. They call me Two. There's another Newman, the driver, he's one. Then there's the engineer and the sergeant and you. So for whatever it's worth, that's five again." No trumpets, no ceremony. This is Werner's induction into the Wehrmacht. They walk the 3 miles from the school to the village. In a delicatessen, black flies swim over half dozen tables. Newman, too, orders 2 plates of calf's liver and eats both, using dark little bread rolls to sop the blood. His lips shine. Werner waits for explanations, where they're going, what sort of unit he'll be joining, but none are forthcoming. The color of the arms displayed under the corporal's shoulder straps and collar tabs is wine red, but Werner can't remember what that is supposed to signify. Armored infantry? Chemical warfare? The old Frau collects the plates. Newman, too, removes a small tin from his coat, dumps 3 round pills on the table, and gulps them down. Then he puts the tin back inside his coat and looks at Werner. "Backache pills, you have money?" Werner shakes his head. From a pocket, Newman, too, pulls some crumpled and filthy Reichmarks. Before they leave, he asks the Frau to bring a dozen hard-boiled eggs and hands Werner four. From Schopforte, they ride a train through Leipzig and disembark at a switching station west of Lodz. Soldiers from an infantry battalion lie along the platform, all of them asleep, as though some enchantress has cast a spell over them. Their faded uniforms look spectral in the dimness, and their breathing seems synchronized, and the effect is ghostly and unnerving. Now and then, a loudspeaker mutters destinations Werner has never heard of. Grima, Wurzen, Grossenhain, though no trains come or go, and the men do not stir. Newman, too, sits with his legs spread and eats eggs one after another, piling the shells into a tower inside his upturned cap. Dusk falls. A soft, tidal snoring issues from the sleepy company. Werner feels as though he and Newman, too, are the only souls awake in the world. Well after dark, a whistle sounds in the east and the drowsing soldiers stir. Werner comes out of a half-dream and sits up. Newman, too, is already upright beside him, palms cupped against each other, as though attempting to hold a sphere of darkness in the bowl of his hands. Couplings rattle, brake blocks grind against wheels, and a train emerges from the gloom, moving fast. First comes a blacked-out locomotive bolted over with armor, exhaling a thick geyser of smoke and steam. Behind the locomotive rumble a few closed cars, then a machine gun in a blister, two gunners crouching beside it. All of the cars following the gunner's car are flat cars, loaded with people. Some stand, more kneel. Two cars pass. Three. Four. Each car appears to have a wall of sacks along the front to serve as windbreak. The rails below the platform shine dully as they bounce beneath the weight. Nine flat cars, 10, 11, all full. The sacks, as they pass, seem strange. They look as though they have been sculpted out of gray clay. Newman, too, raises his chin. Prisoners! Werner tries to pick out individuals as the cars blur past. A sunken cheek, a shoulder, a glittering eye. Are they wearing uniforms? Many sit with their backs against the sacks at the front of the car. They look like scarecrows shipping west to be staked in some terrible garden. Some of the prisoners, Werner sees, are sleeping. A face flashes past, pale and waxy, one ear pressed to the floor of the car. Werner blinks. Those are not sacks. That is not sleep. Each car has a wall of corpses stacked in the front. Once it becomes clear that the train will not stop, all the soldiers around them settle and close their eyes once more. Newman, too, yawns. Car after car the prisoners come, a river of human beings pouring out of the night. 16, 17, 18. Why count? Hundreds and hundreds of men, thousands. Eventually, from the darkness rushes a final flat car, where again the living recline on the dead, followed by the shadow of another gun in a blister and four or five gunners, and then the train is gone. The sound of the axles fades. Silence seals itself back over the forest. Somewhere in that direction is Schopforte with its dark spires, its bedwetters and sleepwalkers and bullies. Somewhere beyond that, the groaning leviathan that is Zollverein, the rattling windows of Children's House. Jutta. Werner says, "They were sitting on their dead?" Newman, too, closes an eye and cocks his head like a rifleman aiming into the darkness where the train has receded. "Bang," he says, "bang, bang." The wardrobe. In the days following the death of Madame Manek, Etienne does not come out of his study. Marie-Laure imagines him hunched in the davenport, mumbling children's rhymes and watching ghosts shuttle through the walls. Behind the door, his silence is so complete that she worries he has managed to depart the world altogether.
Uncle Etienne.
Madame Blanchard walks Marie-Laure to St. Vincent's for Madame Manek's memorial. Madame Fontenot cooks enough potato soup to last a week. Madame Gibault brings jam. Madame Rouet somehow has baked a crumb cake. Hours wear out and fall away. Marie-Laure sets a full plate outside Etienne's door at night and collects an empty plate in the morning. She stands alone in Madame Manek's room and smells peppermint, candle wax, 6 decades of loyalty. Housemaid, nurse, mother, confederate, counselor, chef, what 10,000 things was Madame Manek to Etienne, to them all? German sailors sing a drunken song in the street, and a house spider over the stove spins a new web every night. And to Marie-Laure this is a double cruelty, that everything else keeps living, that the spinning earth does not pause for even an instant in its trip around the sun. Poor child, poor Monsieur Leblanc, like they're cursed. If only her father would come through the kitchen door, smile at the ladies, set his palms on Marie-Laure's cheeks, 5 minutes with him, 1 minute. After 4 days, Etienne comes out of his room. The stairs creak as he descends, and the women in the kitchen fall silent. In a grave voice, he asks everyone to please leave.
I needed time to say goodbye, and now I must look after myself and my niece. Thank you.
As soon as the kitchen door has closed, he turns the deadbolts and takes Marie-Laure's hands.
All the lights are off now. Very good. Please stand over here.
Chairs slide away. The kitchen table slides away. She can hear him fumbling at the ring in the center of the floor. The trap door comes up. He goes down into the cellar.
Uncle, what do you need?
This, he calls.
What is it?
An electric saw.
She can feel something bright kindle in her abdomen. Etienne starts up the stairs, Marie-Laure trailing behind. Second floor, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, left turn into her grandfather's room. He opens the doors of the gigantic wardrobe, lifts out his brother's old clothes, and places them on the bed. He runs an extension cord out onto the landing and plugs it in. He says,
"It will be loud,"
she says. "Good." Etienne climbs into the back of the wardrobe, and the saw yowls to life. The sound permeates the walls, the floor, Marie-Laure's chest. She wonders how many neighbors hear it, if somewhere a German at his breakfast has cocked his head to listen. Etienne removes a rectangle from the back of the wardrobe, then cuts through the attic door behind it. He shuts down the saw and wriggles through the raw hole, up the ladder behind it, and into the garret. She follows. All morning, Etienne crawls along the attic floor with cables and pliers and tools her fingers do not understand, weaving himself into the center of what she imagines as an intricate electronic net. He murmurs to himself. He fetches thick booklets or electrical components from various rooms on the lower stories. The attic creaks. Houseflies draw electric blue loops in the air. Late in the evening, Marie-Laure descends the ladder and falls asleep in her grandfather's bed to the sound of her great-uncle working above her. When she wakes, barn swallows are churring beneath the eaves and music is raining down through the ceiling. Clair de Lune, a song that makes her think of leaves fluttering and of the hard ribbons of sand beneath her feet at low tide. The music slinks and rises and settles back to earth, and then the young voice of her long-dead grandfather speaks.
There are 96,000 kilometers of blood vessels in the human body, children, almost enough to wind around the earth 2½ times. Etienne comes down the 7 ladder rungs and squeezes through the back of the wardrobe and takes her hand in his. Before he speaks, she knows what he will say.
Your father asked me to keep you safe.
I know. This will be dangerous. It is not a game.
I want to do it. Madame would want.
Tell it to me. Tell me the whole routine.
22 paces down the Rue Vaubray to the Rue d'Estrées, then right for 16 storm drains, left on the Rue Robert-Surcouf, 9 more storm drains to the bakery. I go to the counter and say, 1 ordinary loaf, please.
How will she reply?
She will be surprised, but I am supposed to say, 1 ordinary loaf, and she is supposed to say, and how is your uncle?
She will ask about me.
She is supposed to. That's how she will know that you are willing to help. It's what Madame suggested, part of the protocol.
And you will say?
I will say, my uncle is well, thank you. And I will take the loaf and put it in my knapsack and come home.
This will happen even now, without Madame.
Why wouldn't it?
How will you pay?
A ration ticket.
Do we have any of those?
In the drawer downstairs. And you have money, don't you?
Yes, we have some money. How will you come back home?
Straight back.
By which route?
9 storm drains down the Rue Robert-Surcouf, right on the Rue d'Estrées, 16 drains back to the Rue Vaubray. I know it all, Uncle. I have it memorized. We have been to the bakery 300 times.
You mustn't go anywhere else. You mustn't go to the beaches.
I'll come directly back.
You promise?
I promise.
Then go, Marie-Laure. Go like the wind.
East. They ride in boxcars through Lodz, Warsaw, Brest. For miles, out the open door, Werner sees no sign of humans save the occasional rail car capsized beside the tracks, twisted and scarred by some kind of explosion. Soldiers clamor on and off, lean, pale, each carrying a pack, rifle, and steel helmet. They sleep despite noise, despite cold, despite hunger, as though desperate to stay removed from the waking world for as long as possible. Rows of pines divide endless metal-colored plains. The day is sunless. Newman, too, wakes and urinates out the door and takes the pillbox from his coat and swallows 2 or 3 more tablets.
Russia,
he says, though how he has marked the transition, Werner cannot guess. The air smells of steel. At dusk, the train stops, and Newman, too, leads Werner on foot through rows of ruined houses, beams and bricks lying in charred heaps. What walls stand are lined with the black cross-hatchings of machine-gun fire. It's nearly dark when Werner is delivered to a muscle-bound captain dining alone on a sofa that consists of a wooden frame and springs. In a tiny bowl in the captain's lap steams a cylinder of boiled gray meat. He studies Werner a while without saying anything, wearing a look not of disappointment, but tired amusement.
Not making them any bigger, are they?
No, sir.
How old are you?
18, sir.
The captain laughs.
12, more like.
He slices off a circle of meat and chews a long time and finally reaches into his mouth with 2 fingers and flings away a string of gristle.
You'll want to acquaint yourself with the equipment. See if you can do better than the last ones I sent.
Newman, too, leads Werner to the open back of an unwashed Opel Blitz, a cross-country 3-ton truck
with a wooden shell built onto the back. Dented gasoline cans are strapped to one flank. Bullet trails have left wandering perforations down the other. The leaden dust drains away. Newman, too, brings Werner a kerosene lantern.
Gadgets are in sight.
Then he vanishes. No explanations. Welcome to the war. Tiny moths swirl in the lantern light. Fatigue settles into every part of Werner. Is this Hauptmann's idea of a reward or a punishment? He longs to sit on the benches in Children's House again, to hear Frau Elena's songs, to feel the heat pumping off the potbelly stove and the high voices of Siegfried Fischer rhapsodizing about U-boats and fighter planes, to see Jutta drawing at the far end of the table, sketching out the thousand windows of her imaginary city. Inside the truck box lives a smell, clay, spilled diesel mixed with something putrid. Three square windows reflect the lantern light. It's a radio truck. On a bench along the left wall sit a pair of grimy listening decks the size of bed pillows, a folding RF antenna that can be raised and lowered from inside, three headsets, a weapons rack, storage lockers, wax pencils, compasses, maps. And here, in battered cases, wait two of the transceivers he designed with Dr. Hauptmann. To see them all the way out here soothes him, as though he has turned and found an old friend floating beside him in the middle of the sea. He tugs the first transceiver from its case and unscrews the back plate. Its meter is cracked, several fuses are blown, and the transmitter plug is missing. He fishes for tools, a socket key, copper wire. He looks out the open door across the silent camp to where stars are spun in thousands across the sky. Do Russian tanks wait out there, training their guns on the lantern light? He remembers Herr Seidler's big walnut Philco. Stare into the wires, concentrate, assess. Eventually, a pattern will assert itself. When he next looks up, a soft glow shows behind a line of distant trees, as if something is burning out there. Dawn. A half mile away, two boys with sticks slouch behind a drove of bony cattle. Werner is opening the second transceiver case when a giant appears in the back of the truck shell.
Fenink!
The man hangs his long arms from the top bar of the truck canopy. He eclipses the ruined village, the fields, the rising sun.
Volkheimer?
One ordinary loaf. They stand in the kitchen with the curtains drawn. She still feels the exhilaration of leaving the bakery with the warm weight of the loaf in her knapsack. Etienne tears apart the bread. There. He sets a tiny paper scroll no bigger than a cowrie shell in her palm.
What does it say?
Numbers, lots of them. The first three might be frequencies. I can't be sure. The fourth, 2300, might be an hour.
Will we do it now?
We'll wait until it's dark.
Etienne works wires up through the house, threading them behind walls connecting one to a bell on the third floor, beneath the telephone table, another to a second bell in the attic, and a third to the front gate. Three times he has Marie-Laure test it. She stands in the street and swings open the outer gate, and from deep inside the house come two faint rings. Next, he builds a false back into the wardrobe, installing it on a sliding track so it can be opened from either side. At dusk, they drink tea and chew the mealy, dense bread from the Rouel's bakery. When it is fully dark, Marie-Laure follows her great-uncle up the stairs, through the sixth-floor room, and up the ladder into the attic. Etienne raises the heavy telescoping antenna alongside the line of the chimney. He flips switches, and the attic fills with a delicate crackle.
Ready, he sounds like her father when he was about to say something silly.
In her memory, Marie-Laure hears the two policemen. People have been arrested for less, and Madame Manek, don't you want to be alive before you die? Yes. He clears his throat. He switches on the microphone and says, 5-6-7-32-3-0-1-1-5-0-5-0-6-1-1-0-9-0-1-4-6-7-7-5-1. Off go the numbers, winging out across the rooftops, across the sea, flying to who knows what destinations, to England, to Paris, to the dead. He switches to a second frequency and repeats the transmission. A third. Then he shuts the whole thing off. The machine ticks as it cools.
What do they mean, Uncle?
I don't know.
Do they translate into words?
I suppose they must.
They go down the ladder and clamber out through the wardrobe. No soldiers wait in the hall with guns drawn. Nothing seems different at all. A line comes back to Marie-Laure from Jules Verne. Science, my lad, is made up of mistakes, but they are mistakes which it is useful to make because they lead little by little to the truth. Etienne laughs as though to himself.
Do you remember what Madame said about the boiling frog?
Yes, Uncle.
I wonder who was supposed to be the frog, her or the Germans?
Volkheimer. The engineer is a taciturn, pungent man named Walter Bernd, whose pupils are misaligned. The driver is a gap-toothed 30-year-old they call Newman One. Werner knows that Volkheimer, their sergeant, cannot be older than 20, but in the hard, pewter-colored light of dawn, he looks twice that.
Partisans are hitting the trains, he explains. They're organized, and the captain believes they're coordinating attacks with radios.
The last technician, says Newman One, didn't find anything.
It's good equipment, says Werner. I should have them both functioning in an hour.
A gentleness flows into Volkheimer's eyes and hangs there a moment.
Fenning, he says, looking at Werner, is nothing like our last technician.
They begin. The Opel bounces down roads that are hardly more than cattle trails. Every few miles they stop and set up a transceiver on some hump or ridge. They leave Bernd and skinny, leering Newman II, one with a rifle, the other wearing headphones. Then they drive a few hundred yards, enough to build the base of a triangle, calculating distance all the way, and Werner switches on the primary receiver. He raises the truck's aerial, puts on the headset, scans the spectra, trying to find anything that is not sanctioned, any voice that is not allowed. Along the flat, immense horizon, multiple fires seem always to be burning. Most of the time, Werner rides facing backward, looking at the land they are leaving, back toward Poland, back into the Reich. No one shoots at them. Few voices come shearing out of the static, and the ones he does hear are German. At night, Newman One pulls tins of little sausages out of ammunition boxes, and Newman Two makes tired jokes about horrors he remembers or invents. And in nightmares, Werner watches the shapes of boys close over Friedrich, though when he draws closer, Friedrich transforms into Jutta, and she stares at Werner with accusation while the boys carry off her limbs one by one. Every hour, Volkheimer pokes his head into the back of the Opel and meets Werner's eyes. Nothing. Werner shakes his head. He fiddles with the batteries, reconsiders the antennas, triple-checks fuses. At Schulforta with Dr. Hauptmann, it was a game. He could guess Volkheimer's frequency. He always knew whether Volkheimer's transmitter was transmitting. Out here, he doesn't know how or when or where or even if transmissions are being broadcast. Out here, he chases ghosts. All they do is expend fuel driving past smoldering cottages and chewed up artillery pieces and unmarked graves while Volkheimer passes his giant hand over his close-cropped head, growing more uneasy by the day. From miles away comes the thunder of big guns, and still the German transport trains are being hit, bending tracks and flipping cattle cars and maiming the Führer's soldiers and filling his officers with fury. Is that a partisan there, the old man with the saw cutting trees? That one leaning over the engine of that car? What about those three women collecting water at the creek? Frosts show up at night, throwing a silver sheet across the landscape, and Werner wakes in the back of the truck with his fingers mashed in his armpits and his breath showing and tubes of the transceivers glowing a faint blue. How deep will the snow be? 6 feet? 10? 100? Miles deep, thinks Werner. We will drive over everything that once was. Fall. Storms rinse the sky, the beaches, the streets, and a red sun dips into the sea, setting all the west-facing granite in St. Malo on fire, and three limousines with wrapped mufflers glide down the Rue de la Crosse like wraiths, and a dozen or so German officers, accompanied by men carrying stage lights and movie cameras, climb the steps to the Bastion de la Hollande and stroll the ramparts in the cold. From his fifth-floor window, Etienne watches them through a brass telescope, nearly 20 in all, captains and majors and even a lieutenant colonel holding his coat at the collar and gesturing at forts on the outer islands, one of the enlisted men trying to light a cigarette in the wind, the others laughing as his hat goes flying over the battlements. Across the street, from the front door of Claude Lavitte's house, three women spill out laughing. Lights burn in Claude's windows, though the rest of the block has no electricity. Someone opens a third-story window and throws out a shot glass, and off it goes, spinning over and over down toward the Rue Vaubere and out of sight. Etienne lights a candle and climbs to the sixth floor. Marie-Laure has fallen asleep. From his pocket, he takes a coil of paper and unrolls it. He has already given up trying to crack the code. He has written out the numbers, gridded them, added, multiplied. Nothing has come of it. And yet it has. Because Etienne has stopped feeling nauseated in the afternoons. His vision has stayed clear, his heart untroubled. Indeed, it has been over a month since he has had to curl up against the wall in his study and pray that he does not see ghosts shambling through the walls. When Marie-Laure comes through the front door with the bread, when he's opening the tiny scroll in his fingers, lowering his mouth to the microphone, he feels unshakable. He feels alive. 5, 6, 7, 8, 2, 1, 4, 5, 6, 7, 4, 6, 7, 8, 1, 3. Then the time and frequency for the next broadcast. They have been at it for several months, new slips of paper arriving inside a loaf of bread every few days, and lately Etienne plays music, always at night, and never more than a shard of one song, 60 or 90 seconds at the most. Debussy, or Ravel, or Massenet, or Charpentier, he sets the microphone in one bell of his electrophone, as he did years before, and lets the record spin. Who listens? Etienne imagines shortwave receivers disguised as oatmeal boxes, or tucked under floorboards, receivers buried beneath flagstones or concealed inside bassinets. He imagines two or three dozen listeners up and down the coast, maybe more tuning in at sea. captains sets on free ships hauling tomatoes or refugees or guns, Englishmen who expect the numbers but not the music, who must wonder why. Tonight he plays Vivaldi, L'Autunno, Allegro, a record his brother bought at a shop on the Rue Saint-Marguerite 4 decades ago for 55 centimes. The harpsichord plucks along, the violin makes big Baroque flourishes, the low angled space of the attic brims with sound. Beyond the slats a block away and 30 yards below, 12 German officers smile for the cameras. Listen to this, thinks Etienne. Hear this. Someone touches his shoulder. He has to brace himself against the sloping wall to avoid falling over. Marie-Laure stands behind him in her nightdress. The violins spiral down, then back up. Etienne takes Marie-Laure's hand, and together, beneath the low, sloping roof, the record spinning, the transmitter sending it over the ramparts, right through the bodies of the Germans and out to sea, they dance. He spins her. Her fingers flicker through the air. In the candlelight, she looks of another world, her face all freckles, and in the center of the freckles, those two eyes hang unmoving like the egg cases of spiders. They do not track him, but they do not unnerve him. They seem almost to see into a separate, deeper place, a world that consists only of music. Graceful, lean, coordinated as she whirls, though how she knows what dancing is, he could never guess. The song plays on. He lets it go too long. The antenna is still up, probably dimly visible against the sky. The whole attic might as well shine like a beacon. But in the candlelight, in the sweet rush of the concerto, Marie-Laure bites her lower lip, and her face gives off a secondary glow, reminding him of the marshes beyond the town walls in those winter dusks when the sun has set but isn't fully swallowed, and big patches of reeds catch red pools of light and burn, places he used to go with his brother in what seems like lifetimes ago. This, he thinks, is what the numbers mean. The concerto ends. A wasp goes tap-tap-tap along the ceiling. The transmitter remains on, the microphone tucked into the bell of the electrophone as the needle traces the outermost groove. Marie-Laure breathes heavily, smiling. After she has gone back to sleep, after Etienne has blown out his candle, he kneels for a long time beside his bed. The bony figure of death rides the streets below, stopping his mount now and then to peer into windows. Horns of fire on his head and smoke leaking from his nostrils and, in his skeletal hand, a list newly charged with addresses. Gazing first at the crew of officers unloading from their limousines into the chateau, then at the glowing rooms of the perfumer Claude Lavitte, then at the dark, tall house of Etienne Leblanc. Pass us by, horsemen, pass this house by. Sunflowers. They drive a dusky track surrounded by square miles of dying sunflowers so tall that they seem like trees. The stems have dried and stiffened, and the faces bob like praying heads, and as the opal bellows past, Werner feels as if they are being watched by 10,000 cyclopic eyes. Newman 1 breaks the truck, and Bernd unslings his rifle and takes the second transceiver and wades along into the stalks to set it up. Werner raises the big antenna and sits in his usual spot in the box of the opal with his headset on. Up in the cab, Newman, too, says, "You never scrambled her eggs, you old virgin." "Shut your mouth," says Newman, 1. "You jerk yourself to sleep at night.
bleed your weasel, pound your flounder. So does half the army, Germans and Russians alike. Little pubescent Aryan back there is definitely a flounder pounder.
Over the transceiver, Baron reads off frequencies. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Newman 1 says,
the true Aryan is as blonde as Hitler, as slim as Goring, and as tall as Goebbels.
Laughter from Newman 2.
Fuck if,
Volkheimer says,
enough.
It's late afternoon. All day they have moved through this strange and desolate region and have seen nothing but sunflowers. Werner runs the needle through the frequencies, switches bands, retunes the transceiver again, scouring the static. The air swarms with it day and night, a great, sad, sinister Ukrainian static that seems to have been here long before humans figured out how to hear it. Volkheimer clambers out of the truck and lowers his trousers and pees into the flowers, and Werner decides to trim the aerial. But before he does, he hears, as sharp and clear and menacing as the blade of a knife flashing in the sun, a volley of Russian. Один, шесть, восемь. Every fiber of his nervous system leaps awake. He turns up the volume as far as it will go and presses the headphones against his ears. Again it comes. Понье something, фешки, свя something, дороскол. Volkheimer is looking at him through the open back of the truck shell as though he can sense it, as though he is coming awake for the first time in months, as he did that night out in the snow when Hauptmann fired his pistol when they realized Werner's transceivers worked. Werner turns the fine-tuned dial fractionally, and abruptly the voice booms into his ear.
Dvinatset, nyatsketnet, dabitset adin.
Nonsense, terrible nonsense, pipeline directly into his head. It's like reaching into a sack full of cotton and finding a razor blade inside. Everything constant and undeviating, and then that one dangerous thing, so sharp you can hardly feel it open your skin. Volkheimer wraps his massive fist on the side of the Opel to quiet the Newmans, and Werner relays the channel to Bernd on the far transceiver, and Bernd finds it and measures the angle and relays it back. And now Werner settles in to do the math, the slide rule, the trigonometry, the map. The Russian is still talking when Werner pulls his headset down around his neck.
North, northwest. How far?
Only numbers, pure math.
1.5 kilometers. Are they broadcasting now?
Werner closes one cup of the headphones over an ear. He nods. Newman 1 starts the Opel with a roar, and Bernd comes crashing back through the flowers carrying the first transceiver, and Werner withdraws the aerial, and they grind off the road directly through the sunflowers, punching them down as they go. The tallest are nearly as tall as the truck, and their big, dry heads drum the roof of the cab and the sides of the box. Newman 1 watches the odometer and calls out distances. Volkheimer distributes weapons. 2 Karabiner 98Ks. The Walther semi-automatic with the scope. Beside him, Bernd loads cartridges into the magazine of his Mauser. Bong go the sunflowers. Bong, bong, bong. The truck yaws like a ship at sea as Newman 1 coaxes it over ruts.
1,100 meters, calls Newman 1,
and Newman 2 scrambles onto the hood of the truck and peers above the field with binoculars. To the south, the flowers give way to a patch of raveled gherkins. Beyond those, ringed by bare dirt, stands a pretty cottage with a thatched roof and stucco walls. The line of Yarrow ends of the field. Volkheimer raises his scope.
Any smoke?
None.
An antenna?
Hard to say.
Shut off the motor, on foot from here.
Everything goes quiet. Volkheimer, Newman 2, and Bernd carry their weapons into the flowers and are swallowed. Newman 1 stays behind the wheel, Werner in the truck shell. No landmines explode in front of them. All around the opal, the flowers creak on their stems and nod their heliotropic faces as if in some sad accord.
"Fuckers are going to be surprised," whispers Newman 1.
His right thigh jogs up and down several times a second. Behind him, Werner raises the aerial as high as he dares and clamps on the headphones and switches on the transceiver. The Russian is reading what sounds like letters of the alphabet. P, Z, K, Ch, U, Maki, Znak. Each utterance seems to rise from the oral cotton for Werner's ears alone, then melts away. Newman One's vibrating leg shakes the truck lightly, and the sun flares through the remnants of insects smeared across the windows, and a cold wind sets the whole field rustling. Won't there be sentries, lookouts, armed partisans sidling up right now behind the truck? The Russian on the radio is a hornet in each ear. Zval, kas, ukvolv. Who knows what horrors he's dispensing? Troop positions, train schedules. He might be giving artillery gunners the truck's location right now. And Volkheimer is walking out of the sunflowers, as large a target as a human has ever presented, holding his rifle like a baton. It seems impossible that the cottage could ever accommodate him, as though Volkheimer will engulf the house instead of the other way around. First, the shots come through the air around the headphones. A fraction of a second later, they come through the headphones themselves, so loud that Werner almost tears them off. Then even the static cuts out, and the silence in the headphones feels like something massive moving through space, a ghostly airship slowly descending. Newman One opens and closes the bolt of his rifle. Werner remembers crouching next to his cot with Jutta after the Frenchman would sign off, the windows rattling from some passing coal train, the echo of the broadcast seeming to glimmer in the air for a moment, as though he could reach out and let it float down into his hands. Volkheimer returns with ink spattered on his face. He raises two huge fingers to his forehead, pushes his helmet back, and Werner can see that it is not ink.
"Set the house afire," he says. "Quickly, don't waste diesel."
He looks at Werner, his voice tender, almost melancholy.
"Salvage the equipment."
Werner sets down the headphones, puts on his helmet. Swifts swoop out over the sunflowers. His vision makes slow loops as though something has gone wrong with his balance. Newman One hums in front of him as he carries a can of fuel through the stalks. They break through the sunflowers toward the cottage, stepping through Aaron's rod, wild carrot, all the leaves brown from frost. Beside the front door, a dog lies in the dust, chin on its paws, and for a moment, Werner thinks it is only sleeping. The first dead man is on the floor with an arm trapped beneath him and a crimson mess where his head should be. On the table is a second man, slumped as if sleeping on his ear, only the edges of his wound showing a whorish purple. Blood that has spread across the table thickens like cooling wax. It looks almost black. Strange to think of his voice still flying through the air, already a country away, growing weaker every mile. Torn pants, grimy jackets, one of the men in suspenders. They do not wear uniforms. Newman One tears down a potato sack curtain and takes it outside, and Werner can hear him splash it with diesel. Newman Two pulls the suspenders off the second dead man and takes some braided shallots from the lintel and bundles them against his chest and leaves. In the kitchen, A small brick of cheese sits half-eaten, a knife beside it with a faded wooden handle. Werner opens a single cupboard. Inside dwells a den of superstition. Jars of dark liquids, unlabeled pain remedies, molasses, tablespoons stuck to the wood. Something marked in Latin, belladonna, something else marked with an X. The transmitter is poor, high frequency, probably salvaged from a Russian tank. Seems little more than a handful of components shoveled into a box. The ground plane antenna installed beside the cottage might have sent the transmissions 30 miles, if that. Werner goes out, looks back at the house, bone white in the failing light. He thinks of the kitchen cupboard with its strange potions, the dog that did not do its job. These partisans may have been involved in some dark forest magic, but they should not have been tinkering with the higher magic of radio. He slings his rifle and carries the big battered transmitter, its leads, its inferior microphone, through the flowers to the opal, its engine running, Newman too and Volkheimer already in the cab. He hears Dr. Hauptmann. A scientist's work is determined by two things, his interests and those of his time. Everything has led to this, the death of his father, all those restless hours with Jutta listening to the crystal radio in the attic, Hans and Herbert wearing their red armbands under their shirts so Frau Elena would not see. 400 dark, glittering nights at Schulpforta building transceivers for Dr. Hauptmann. The destruction of Friedrich. Everything leading to this moment as Werner piles the haphazard Cossack equipment into the shell of the truck and sits with his back against the bench and watches the light from the burning cottage rise above the field. Bernd climbs in beside him, rifle in his lap, and neither bothers to close the back door when the opal roars into gear. Stones. Sergeant Major von Rumpel is summoned to a warehouse outside Lodz. It is the first time he has traveled since completing his treatments in Stuttgart, and he feels as though the density of his bones has decreased. 6 guards in steel helmets wait inside razor wire. Much heel-clicking and saluting ensues. He takes off his coat and steps into a zippered jumpsuit with no pockets. 3 deadbolts give way. Through a door, 4 enlisted men in identical jumpsuits stand behind tables with jeweler's lamps bolted to each. Plywood has been nailed over all the windows. A dark-haired Gefreiter explains the protocol. A first man will pry the stones out of their settings. A second will scrub them one by one in a bath of detergent. A third will weigh each, announce its mass, and pass it to von Rumpel, who will examine the stone through a loop and call out the clarity included, slightly included, almost loop clean. A fifth man, the Gefreiter, will record the assessments. "We'll work in 10-hour shifts until we're done." Von Rumpel nods. Already his spine feels as if it might splinter. The Gefreiter drags a padlocked sack from beneath his table, unthreads a chain from its throat, and upends it onto a velvet-lined tray. Thousands of jewels spill out. Emeralds, sapphires, rubies, citrine, peridot, chrysoberyl. Among them twinkle hundreds upon hundreds of little diamonds, most still in necklaces, bracelets, cufflinks, or earrings. We've come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. Preceding program was a production of Sight and Sound Radio.